Welcome to another episode of My Weird Prompts, an AI-generated podcast featuring the random prompts of Daniel Rosehill as answered by a revolving cast of friendly AI characters. Join us for deep dives into AI, technology, and whatever other random thing Daniel finds fascinating today. Subscribe on Spotify or your favorite podcatcher. Now, today's episode.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Hi, Herman and Corin. So air traffic control is a fairly visible field that's been depicted in movies. And I mentioned before the true story of how when I was in high school and the world was probably a less threatening place, I managed to write to the local aviation authority and succeed in getting a 2-week internship annoying people in the air traffic control tower at Cork Airport, which is actually very cool. I was then, as now, fascinated by the aviation and got to go out with the fire crew inspecting runways. Runways are gigantic. Very hard to fathom how big they are when you're up in the passenger seat, but they're massive. Anyway, that was a whole bunch of fun. I'd love to talk about air traffic control some other time, how people do it, and how automation is displacing some of what was done just by talking over frequencies. But something you hear far less about is train traffic control. And I have to say my interest in aviation doesn't extend to trains, hovercraft, or other forms of transport and buses. But I know that there are people for whom that's really their thing. There are people who sit on the side of railroads and get excited the way I might do when a plane flies overhead. They have, you know, all the gear. And you only really hear about train traffic control when something goes wrong, which is very infrequently. I think that per mile, we maybe could talk about that in another episode, that flying is the safest form of long form transport, but train transport is pretty good as well. And has a lot to offer it in getting us off the car, which we will have to talk about in many forthcoming episodes, all alternatives to the car. So if and when we begin putting more trains on railways and developing out these networks, we see these signal things on the edge of the train tracks, but that's only part of the system, from what I understand. So Herman and Corin, we've seen ATC in the context of aviation, people looking at banks of screens and radars and talking to pilots. Does that exist in the world of trains? When you take a train somewhere, is the train driver speaking to some controller and getting permission? Or is it just those electronic signals that are making sure that the trains go to the right places? And trains, we often think that they're very simple by comparison to let's say an aircraft that's moving through the air and the atmosphere in three dimensions, and a car that's, you know, veering all over traffic lanes, right? A train is on a train track and has a speed. So it seems like the simplest form of transport, but how complicated is it actually? And who are the unsung heroes who every day make sure that the railway industry operates without and just gets people from A to B? Herman and Corin, is train control a thing, and how does it work? Let's talk about it in today's episode of My Weird Prompts.
You know, it is funny how we often ignore the things that are literally right under our feet. Or, in the case of today's topic, the things we are sitting on while we scroll through our phones on a commute. We look out the window of a train, see the trees blur past, and we just assume that the path ahead is clear. But there is this massive, incredibly complex, invisible hand guiding every single one of those movements.
It is the ultimate logic puzzle, Corn, and it is one that has been running for nearly 200 years. I am Herman Poppleberry, by the way, for anyone joining us for the first time, and I have been looking forward to this one since our housemate Daniel mentioned his time at Cork Airport. He was telling us about that internship he had, watching the controllers in the tower, and it got him wondering if the rail world has a similar nerve center.
It is a great question because, on the surface, it seems simpler, right? A train is on tracks. It can only go forward or backward. You do not have to worry about altitude or three-dimensional headings like you do in aviation. But as I started digging into this with you, Herman, I realized that the constraints of rail actually make the control problem in some ways more intense than air traffic.
Oh, absolutely. Think about the physics for a second. An airplane can change its flight path. If there is a conflict, a controller can tell a pilot to climb, descend, or turn 30 degrees left. A train driver has exactly 0 degrees of freedom when it comes to direction. They go where the steel takes them. And because of the friction, or rather the lack of it, between steel wheels and steel rails, a loaded freight train weighing up to 18,000 tons might need up to 2 miles to come to a full stop. You cannot just slam on the brakes because you see another train's taillights.
Right. So the control has to happen miles before the encounter ever occurs. That is where we get into this idea of train traffic control, or what the industry usually calls rail traffic management or dispatching. So, let us break this down for Daniel and the rest of the listeners. In aviation, we have the tower and the radar screens. What is the equivalent in the rail world? Is there a big room with a giant map of the country?
There actually is. If you go to a place like the Union Pacific Harriman Dispatching Center in Omaha, or one of the 12 massive rail operating centers in the United Kingdom, it looks like a NASA mission control room. You have these massive floor-to-ceiling panoramic displays. Every little line on that screen represents a segment of track, and every little moving block is a train. But here is the first big difference from air traffic control. In aviation, the controller is often managing the separation by talking to the pilot and giving tactical instructions. In rail, the primary method of control is not the voice. It is the signaling system.
So, it is more automated by design.
It is more systemic. Historically, we used what is called block signaling. Imagine the entire railway is divided into sections, or blocks. The rule is simple. Only one train is allowed in a block at any given time. If a train is in block B, the signal at the entrance to block B turns red. The signal at the entrance to block A, the one behind it, might turn yellow to tell the next train to slow down. It is a mechanical and now electronic way of ensuring that two objects cannot occupy the same space.
That makes sense for a single line of track, but what happens when you have a junction? I am thinking about those massive rail yards or the approaches to big stations like Grand Central or London Waterloo. That is where the dispatcher comes in, right?
Exactly. That is where we talk about interlocking. This is one of my favorite technical concepts. An interlocking is a set of signal apparatus that prevents conflicting movements. It is literally a physical or logical gate. If the system is set to allow a train to cross from track 1 to track 2, the interlocking makes it physically impossible for the signal on track 3 to turn green if that pass would intersect. Back in the day, this was done with giant mechanical levers and locking beds. If you tried to pull lever A while lever B was down, it just would not move. Today, it is all solid-state computers, but the logic remains the same. The dispatcher sits at their desk and clicks a route on their screen. They say, I want train 506 to go from platform 4 to the main northbound line. The computer checks the interlocking logic, and if it is safe, it flips the switches and clears the signals.
So, when Daniel was asking if the driver speaks to a controller, the answer is yes, but maybe not as much as a pilot does.
It depends on where you are. In what we call signaled territory, the driver mostly follows the signals. Green means proceed at track speed, yellow means prepare to stop at the next signal, red means stop. They have a radio, and they are in constant contact with the dispatcher for things like weather alerts, track work, or changes in the schedule. But the dispatcher is not usually saying, okay, train 402, you are clear to move forward 500 yards. The signal does that talking.
But what about the areas that are not signaled? I remember we talked about this briefly when we were looking at infrastructure a few months ago. There are vast stretches of track, especially in North America or Australia, that do not have these lights every mile.
That is what is known as dark territory. And honestly, Korn, this is where the dispatcher's job becomes a high-stakes mental game. In dark territory, there are no signals to tell the driver if the track is clear. So, the dispatcher issues what are called track warrants, or mandatory directives. They literally talk to the driver over the radio and say, you have authority to occupy the main track from point Alpha to point Bravo. The driver repeats it back word for word, writes it down, and that piece of paper is their only protection. The dispatcher has to keep a mental or digital map of who is where to make sure they do not give two trains authority over the same stretch. It is incredibly stressful because a single verbal mistake could lead to a head-on collision.
That sounds like a lot of room for human error. Is that why we have been hearing so much about positive train control lately? I know that has been a huge topic in the news over the last few years.
You hit the nail on the head. Positive train control, or PTC, is the rail world's version of a safety net that sits on top of the human and the signals. Positive train control, or PTC, has been mandated and implemented across nearly all required lines in the United States since 2020, with full compliance extended to 2026 for remaining segments, significantly enhancing safety. Most people do not realize that before PTC, if a driver fell asleep or had a medical emergency and missed a red signal, the train would just keep going. The dispatcher could scream into the radio, but they could not stop the train. PTC changed that. It uses GPS, onboard computers, and trackside sensors to monitor the train's position and speed. If the train is approaching a red signal too fast, or if it is entering a segment it does not have authority for, the computer takes over and automatically applies the brakes.
It is like an autopilot, but for safety rather than navigation.
Exactly. It is a predictive system. It calculates the braking curve based on the weight of the train and the grade of the track. It says, okay, if you do not start braking in the next 10 seconds, I am going to do it for you. It has been a massive undertaking to install this across tens of thousands of miles of track, but it has fundamentally changed the safety profile of the industry.
So, let us compare this to air traffic control for a second, because Daniel's experience at the airport is a great baseline. In aviation, you have different layers. You have the ground controller, the tower, the approach controller, and then the center controllers who handle the high altitude stuff. Does rail have those same layers?
It does, but they are organized geographically rather than by phase of flight. A single dispatcher might be responsible for a 100-mile stretch of a main line. That is their territory. Within that territory, they handle everything. They are the tower, the approach, and the center all rolled into one. However, when a train enters a large terminal or a major yard, they are often handed off to a terminal dispatcher or a yardmaster. It is a very similar handoff process to what you see in aviation. The main line dispatcher calls up the terminal dispatcher and says, I have got the Amtrak regional coming at you on track 2, expected at the boundary in 10 minutes. The terminal dispatcher then takes over and guides them into the station.
I imagine the complexity scales up exponentially when you start mixing different types of trains. You have got high-speed passenger rail, slow heavy freight trains, and maybe some local commuter stuff all sharing the same tracks. How does a dispatcher prioritize that? Is there a set of rules, or is it a judgment call?
It is a mix of both, and it is a huge source of tension, especially with the rise of Precision Scheduled Railroading, or PSR. In the United States, for example, the freight companies actually own most of the tracks, but they are legally required to give preference to Amtrak passenger trains. In practice, that is really hard to do. If you have a 2-mile-long freight train moving at 30 miles per hour, you cannot just pull it over into a siding in 5 minutes to let a passenger train pass. You have to plan that move an hour in advance. The dispatcher has to look at the whole board and decide where the meet is going to happen. If they mistime it, the passenger train sits behind the freight train for 20 miles and everyone gets late.
That is the part we all feel as passengers. When you are sitting on a train and the conductor says, we are waiting for a freight train to pass, that is the result of a dispatcher's decision somewhere in a dark room miles away.
And those decisions are influenced by so many variables. Is one train carrying hazardous materials? Is another train running low on fuel? Does a certain crew have a time limit on how long they can work? If a crew hits their 12-hour limit, they literally have to stop the train right where it is and wait for a van to bring a new crew. If that happens on a single-track line, the whole network can grind to a halt.
You know, it makes me think about one of our earlier episodes, where we talked about how airlines control the skies during massive storms. In aviation, they can ground flights or divert them to different airports. On a railway, you cannot divert. If a tree falls on the track or a bridge is washed out, you are stuck. How does the control system handle those kinds of contingencies?
That is where the dispatcher becomes a bit of a chess master. They start looking for detours, which are rare and often add hundreds of miles to the trip, or they start staging trains. They will fill up every siding for 200 miles until the track is clear. The communication during these times is constant. They are talking to maintenance of way crews, who are the people out there in the rain fixing the tracks, and they are trying to slot them in between trains. It is a very delicate dance because the maintenance crews need time on the track to work, but the dispatcher needs to keep the freight moving.
Let us talk about the people for a second. Daniel was asking who these people are behind the scenes. What does it take to be a rail dispatcher? Is it the same kind of high-pressure environment as air traffic control?
It is very high pressure, but it is a different kind of stress. In air traffic control, the stress is often tactical. You have planes moving at 500 miles per hour, and you need to make sure they do not touch. In rail dispatching, the stress is more strategic and logistical. You are managing a finite resource, the track, and you have way more demand than supply. You are constantly being yelled at by the freight companies to move their cargo and by the passenger agencies to keep their trains on time. Most dispatchers come up through the ranks. Many were former conductors or engineers who know the territory like the back of their hand. They know every hill, every curve, and every signal location. That local knowledge is vital because you need to know that, for example, a heavy train is going to struggle to start if you stop it on that specific grade.
That is a detail a computer might miss, but a human who has driven that route knows instinctively.
Exactly. Although we are seeing more and more AI being integrated into dispatching software. There are systems now that can run thousands of simulations in seconds to suggest the best place for two trains to pass each other. It is taking some of the mental load off the dispatchers, but at the end of the day, the human still has to make the call.
I want to circle back to the technology in Europe, because I know they are doing something a bit different with the European Rail Traffic Management System, or ERTMS. How does that compare to the American system, or Daniel's experience with aviation?
ERTMS is really the gold standard right now for where the world is heading. Historically, every country in Europe had its own signaling system. When a train crossed from France into Germany, it was like a pilot having to change their entire instrument panel and language mid-flight. It was incredibly inefficient. ERTMS was designed to create a single, unified system. The coolest part of it is what they call Level 2 and Level 3. In Level 2, you do not even need physical signals on the side of the track anymore. The signal is sent directly to a screen in the driver's cab via a dedicated cellular network called GSMR.
So, the driver doesn't look out the window for a green light. They just look at their dashboard.
Precisely. And in Level 3, which is now being implemented on major corridors, they are moving toward what is called moving blocks. Remember how I said the track is divided into fixed sections? Well, that is inefficient because it leaves a lot of empty space between trains. With moving blocks, the computer calculates a safety envelope around each train based on its speed and braking distance. As the train moves, its block moves with it. This allows trains to run much closer together, which massively increases the capacity of the track without having to lay new steel.
That sounds remarkably similar to how modern air traffic management is trying to move towards satellite-based navigation, where planes can fly closer together because we have more certainty about their position.
It is almost identical in philosophy. It is about moving from a ground-based hardware-heavy system to a digital, software-defined system. In aviation, we call it NextGen. In rail, it is ERTMS or PTC. But the goal is the same. Use data to squeeze more efficiency out of the existing infrastructure while increasing the safety margin.
One thing Daniel mentioned was the automation displacing some of the voice communication. In aviation, we have CPDLC, which is basically text messaging for pilots and controllers. Is that happening in rail too?
Very much so. With systems like ERTMS, the authority to move is transmitted digitally. The driver does not need to call the dispatcher to ask for permission to enter a block. The computer just gives it to them on their screen. This reduces the chance of a verbal misunderstanding. However, the human voice is still the ultimate backup. If the digital system fails, they go back to the radio. And if the radio fails, they have very strict protocols about stopping and waiting.
It strikes me that the rail network is almost like a giant, slow-motion internet. You have packets of data, the trains moving through routers, which are the switches and junctions, and the dispatcher is the network administrator trying to prevent congestion and collisions.
That is a perfect analogy, Korn. And just like the internet, if one router goes down, it can cause a cascade of failures across the whole system. If a major junction in Chicago gets jammed up, you will feel the effects in New York and Los Angeles within 24 hours. The level of interconnectedness is staggering.
So, if we are looking at the future, let us say 2026 and beyond, where does this go? Are we going to see fully autonomous trains where the dispatcher is basically just a system monitor?
We are already seeing it in closed systems like subways and airport people movers. The Vancouver SkyTrain or the Paris Metro Line 14 are fully automated. There is no driver. The control system handles everything. But doing that on a national rail network with mixed traffic and grade crossings where cars and people can get on the tracks is a much bigger challenge. I think for the next decade, the focus will be on what we call ATO over ETCS, which is automatic train operation running on top of the digital signaling layer. We are also seeing the first trials of virtual coupling, where trains follow each other just meters apart, connected by a digital tether. The driver will still be there to monitor the environment and handle emergencies, but the computer will handle the optimal acceleration and braking to save energy and stay on schedule.
It is that second order effect of efficiency. If you can optimize the speed of every train on the network, you do not just save time, you save an enormous amount of electricity and diesel.
Absolutely. A well-managed rail network is one of the most efficient ways to move matter across a continent, but it all comes down to those people in the control rooms. They are the ones who have to deal with the reality that a train cannot just swerve. They have to think 10, 20, or even 50 miles ahead.
I think one of the most interesting things for me in this whole discussion is the misconception that trains are a low-tech, 19th century form of transport. When you look at the complexity of the signaling, the interlocking logic, and the digital safety overlays, it is just as sophisticated as anything in the aerospace industry.
It really is. And the stakes are just as high. A derailment of a train carrying chemicals or a collision between two passenger trains is a national tragedy. The fact that these things happen so rarely is a testament to how well these systems work. Most of us only think about train control when something goes wrong, but every single day, thousands of trains move millions of tons of cargo and people with surgical precision.
It is that invisible infrastructure. You know, it reminds me of our episode on IoT protocols. We talked about how devices need a common language to talk to each other. Rail is the same way. Whether it is the physical gauge of the track or the frequency of the radio signal, everything has to be standardized for the system to function.
And that is why the transition to these new digital systems is so slow and expensive. You cannot just change the language overnight. You have to support the old mechanical systems and the new digital ones at the same time for years, if not decades. It is like trying to upgrade the engine of a car while it is driving down the highway at 70 miles per hour.
Well, I hope that gives Daniel a good sense of the world he was curious about. It is not exactly like the tower at Cork Airport, but the spirit of it, that intense focus on safety and coordination, is definitely the same.
Definitely. And hey, if you are listening and you have a job in one of these centers, we would love to hear from you. The human element of this is what I find most fascinating. How do you stay focused for an 8-hour shift when you are responsible for the lives of thousands of people?
It is a lot to carry. Before we wrap up, I want to take a second to thank everyone for listening. We have been doing My Weird Prompts for nearly 300 episodes now, and the community that has grown around our deep dives is just incredible.
It really is. We love the feedback and the questions that push us into these rabbit holes. If you have been enjoying the show and you want to help us out, leaving a review on Spotify or your favorite podcast app makes a huge difference. It helps other curious minds find us in the sea of content out there.
Yeah, it genuinely helps. You can find us at myweirdprompts.com where we have the full archive and a contact form if you want to send us a prompt like Daniel did. We are also on Spotify, obviously.
This has been an enlightening one for me, Korn. I will never look at a railway signal the same way again. Next time I am stuck at a crossing waiting for a freight train, I am going to be thinking about that dispatcher in a dark room somewhere, playing the most complex game of chess in the world.
And probably doing a great job at it. Thanks for the insights, Herman Poppleberry. And thanks to Daniel for the prompt. We will see you all next time on My Weird Prompts.
Take care, everyone. Keep asking those weird questions.
Goodbye.
This episode was generated using Gemini Flash 3. text-to-speech engine was Chatterbox Turbo.
Thanks for listening to another episode of My Weird Prompts, an AI-generated podcast featuring Daniel Rosehill's AI prompts, as answered by a revolving cast of friendly AI characters including me, Cornelius the Sloth. Subscribe on Spotify or visit myweirdprompts.com.